Welcome. We're really excited about this session today. For those of you who are with us, this is a great topic to ponder with your leadership team during the summer months. So Drew will tell you it doesn't take that many months to get up and implemented, but certainly in terms of some of the ramp up and some of the education and some of the buy-in that you need to get from other folks on campus, there is some of that that definitely would be taking place over the summer. So thank you so much to Drew Coco for coming forward and presenting this today. Drew is the Director of Enrollment Management at the Montgomery School. I'll let him give a little more of his background and his next steps, his exciting next steps. But we're here today to talk about a continuous enrollment model and really the benefits, you know, probably some cons, but mostly pros of implementing this. And Drew and others with whom I've worked who have implemented this type of model have pretty much said it's life-changing in a lot of ways. I mean, not that it's the like silver bullet and solves all your enrollment problems, but certainly that it's a strategy that has made a big difference in a lot of enrollment offices. So Drew, without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to you and let you take us away.
Thanks, Debbie. I appreciate it. Hi, everyone. My name is Drew Coco. I am, as Debbie said, the Director of Enrollment Management at Montgomery School. I've been in this role for the last 3 years. Prior to that, I was at a couple of schools in Delaware. Prior to that, I was a full-time high school English teacher, but I'm actually making a little bit of a shift next month, officially. I am joining the Clarity tuition team full-time. If anyone hasn't heard of us, Clarity is a new financial aid software platform right alongside SSS, FACS, FAST. And what we have tried to do with that system is make it a lot faster and easier for families to apply for financial aid, a lot more transparent, and then give schools more robust data and financial reporting analytics on that side of things. So we're excited about the work that we're doing over there. But today, I really want to talk about the experience that we've had at Montgomery in implementing a continuous enrollment model. And I'm gonna actually take this story all the way back to 2019 with ASAP out in Colorado Springs when I attended a session from the late Larry Jensen and Sam Geisler when they talked about continuous enrollment model and how they did it at their schools. And it just seems so practical and so useful. And then it made all the sense in the world. And they even in their presentation harkened back to the likes of Pat Bassett, who I believe they quoted as saying something along the lines of, we're pretty much the only industry that begs people to stay with us each year and gives them the opportunity to reconsider their options. So that kind of really resonated with me. And over the course of the next couple of years, just thought a lot about it, talked to our board about it. Then of course, COVID hit. And so that delayed the process a little bit, but we are now in kind of the end of our first full cycle of implementing continuous enrollment model. And I'll say first cycle, because that's really the cycle is more than one school year to really fully see the benefits of this. And we'll talk a little bit about implementation calendar and everything that that we've seen at Montgomery as we go through. And I do want to encourage people to jump in with questions. I want this to be as much back and forth as possible. Debbie will relay your questions to me as we go, but definitely do not hold the questions to the end. So let's jump right in. First, what is continuous, perpetual, evergreen enrollment, whatever you want to call it? We don't have an industry standard name for it yet. But essentially, you know, I would say it's a shift in mindset. Instead of giving families an opportunity to leave every year, we're assuming that our families are intending to stay. And so we're shifting that mindset around, are you going to stay with us, to we think you're going to stay with us. Are you going to leave us? And so with that is also a shift in practice. Currently with re-enrollment contracts, we need all of our families to do the work, to fill out the re-enrollment contracts, physically and then get them back to us. Even if it's an online re-enrollment contract, that's still a to-do list item for families. And to leave, families simply don't do it. So it's actually easier to leave a school in some ways than it is to stay at a school. And you know, if you think about it, really there aren't any businesses, very few businesses that I could think of that actually use this model. You know, thinking about Netflix, right? What happens with your Netflix subscription? Well, you know, they just keep billing you. Think about your insurance. They just keep billing you. They don't ask you every year if you want to still use their services. They just assume that you do. And so we're shifting that practice. But with that, it also means that we have to shift our policy, right? Our current enrollment contracts cannot be sort of easily cribbed into a continuous or perpetual contract. You really do need to go all the way back to your basics and rewrite an entire contract from soup to nuts. And that's really one of the biggest initial time commitments and energy commitments on the side of your school is actually going through that whole contract rewrite. And that for us was kind of the most daunting part of this journey of moving to a continuous enrollment model. But the idea is that you rewrite the contract so that it's signed one time and is valid until graduation or until family gives notice of departure. So what we did at Montgomery was we put in place a formal withdrawal form. So if a family wants to leave, they have to fill out that withdrawal form. And we didn't make it easy for them to get that withdrawal form. They have to have a conversation with the enrollment office in order to get the form. So there aren't any sort of families leaving without talking to us first. And that gives us an opportunity to have a conversation, to do an exit interview, to get a sense of why it is that they're leaving. And also, again, puts the onus on that family who's thinking about leaving to make the effort to do a little bit of work to get out of the school, and then rewards the families who are staying with a lot less work. So what are we trying to solve for here? We're trying to, in my opinion, we're trying to solve for kind of three big challenges. The uncertainty that we have. Many schools, certainly Montgomery included, and especially K through 12 and K through 8 schools, we are all too familiar with the ups and downs of summer enrollment. So at the same time that we are trying to set our classes and figure out our staffing and figure out our budgeting, there's so much uncertainty due to families that we're not 100% certain whether or not they're coming back. And so it's really hard to plan when we need to plan, which is, you know, early spring, ideally, is when we're going to be planning our staffing and making our hiring and planning, starting to plan our sections. So continuous enrollment will help to solve for that, a lot of that uncertainty. It's also going to help to solve for some office inefficiencies. If you think about just the work hours that your office might spend chasing down re-enrollment contracts that are somehow lost on the countertops of America, I would like love to write a book, you know, about all of those enrollment contracts, but I'm sure we've all heard that excuse. Like, hey, you know, your enrollment contract was due last week. You know, what's going on? You guys coming back? Oh yeah, totally. Absolutely. I'm so sorry. It's on my counter at home. Like, where are all of these counters filled with enrollment contracts? So that time that you spend chasing down contracts would be cut down tremendously. I'm never going to say that continuous enrollment is going to completely solve for all of the chasing. There's always going to be a little bit of chasing. We're never going to completely eliminate that, I don't think. But if you can eliminate 90 to 95% of the chasing, that's going to relieve a lot of work hours, and it will allow you to take that time and use it more efficiently in onboarding new families, doing that the prospecting and the enrollment work that you really should be doing at that time as you seek to fill the school. And then finally, we're trying to solve for some of the family experience, right? Again, as a customer or a consumer, I don't want to have to do work to continue with my same service. I don't want it to be hard for me to stay with my school. I want it to be easy for me to stay with my school. So, you know, kind of, again, solving for that, the user experience is something that continuous enrollment can help with. And so I'm providing just kind of these bullets for you that pretty much just go through what I just overviewed. So again, uncertainty, budgeting, sectioning, and staffing, the inefficiencies of chasing down contracts, allowing you to refocus your efforts on new students, eliminating a lot of redundant paperwork, right? I mean, there are some schools where, you know, you send the re-enrollment contract out, but you don't have your financial aid done yet. So then you sign it, you send out a full pay contract to all of your families, and then you send out a new contract with the financial aid attached to the financial aid families, and they have to sign two contracts. It's just a lot of work. It's a lot of burden on the families. It's a lot of burden on your office. And then again, solving for some of the family experiences, we want to make families rewarded for staying with the school by having to do less work, and put the onus on the families who are thinking about leaving. So I'll just pause there because the next section is going to be getting into some of the nitty gritty around legal logistics, challenges, some of the questions that we get a lot about financial aid and how to handle that kind of stuff. But this is just kind of the philosophical overview. So I'll stop there and invite any questions to come in.
Yeah. So questions, people can just throw them in the chat box or throw them in the Q&A box. We are on Zoom webinar versus Zoom meeting, so you aren't able to unmute yourself. But no questions at the moment, Drew, and I will we'll keep going if some pop in. So
sounds good. So key legal and logistical considerations. I mean, this is again one of the biggest hurdles, I think, for a lot of schools. Is thinking about how would we even set this up? What should this even look like? And where do we get started? So I would say super important to be sure that you have an experienced lawyer draft the agreement. At Montgomery, we used a law firm that had experience, direct experience, creating perpetual enrollment contracts for schools. I would not necessarily recommend going to your normal law firm that is your retained counsel for your school. I would definitely do the research, find the connections, and make sure you're using a firm or lawyer that has experience drafting precisely these types of agreements. I would ensure that you have a good high-level group of people reviewing the language of the agreement. Definitely needs to involve your head of school and your CFO. I think it's great to involve division heads as well, because one of the biggest questions that we got from our division heads was, well, what happens with continuous enrollment when I have a student who I want to put on, you know, academic probation, or who in a normal year I would want to hold that contract? And so you would want those division heads to be involved in the language and the reviewing to make sure that there's going to be language in the contract, in the agreement, that gives the school the ability to make those kinds of decisions that would be equivalent to, you know, not releasing a contract for that student. And basically what some of that language might look like is, you know, the school retains the right to, you know, terminate or suspend a student's enrollment for whatever reason at any time. So there's ways to cover that. So the school always retains that ability to change or terminate a contract at any point. One of the more important documents that I'm going to be sharing after this, if you haven't read it, the NAIS legal brief on continuous enrollment contracts is really, really helpful when you're thinking about doing this for your school. They point out a lot of the potential pitfalls and how to cover yourself against those pitfalls, a lot of the pros and cons about looking at this kind of model for your school. And so I'm going to provide that along with this slideshow. So you can review that document as well. But one of the most important things that I pulled out of the NIS report was three kind of key tenets for your continuous contract, which is flexibility, enforceability, and comprehensiveness. You want to make sure that this agreement is going to be flexible so that the school is not tying its own hands behind its back. Again, an example would be like a division head who wants to maybe hold an enrollment contract for whatever reason, academic reason, or a CFO who needs to hold a contract because somebody's in arrears with their payments. You need to make sure it's enforceable, right? Just like our current annual enrollment contracts and re-enrollment contracts, they need to be legally enforceable. You have to be able to say to a family, look, you had this contract, you signed this contract, it's binding. and you're breaching the contract. It has to be able to hold up if you were to ever go to court or something like that with your contract. It needs to be enforceable. And different states, you know, are going to have different levels of strictness around what constitutes enforceability, which again goes back to the making sure that you have a really experienced lawyer draft that agreement, someone who has experience in your state drafting an agreement that is precisely the same type of agreement, and preferably for schools. You want to make sure that it's comprehensive. You got to make sure you're covering all of your bases. I mean, that I think that's just basically good contract policy. We went at Montgomery from having a one-sided one-page contract to a 10-page contract. So it got a lot more comprehensive, and you know, it was just a good exercise for us to update that contract, which really I don't think had been looked at for a number of years. And you might find that your school's in a similar in a similar place. And then finally, I would say, please do not try to use another school's continuous enrollment agreement for your school. I am sharing some of the language, little snippets as examples from our contract, but I would never say, you know, hey, you know, call up your friend in the other state who is already doing continuous enrollment and then see if you can just get their agreement and then change the name of the school to your school, and then that would be okay. I would not recommend that. You're going to want to make sure that your continuous enrollment agreement is drafted specifically for your school from the ground up. So I would say that's very, very important. And here's an example, again, around that flexibility, enforceability, comprehensiveness that we built into our continuing enrollment contract. And basically establishing that, you know, parent, and here we're defining parent as also inclusive of guardians. So understands the parent will not be asked to sign another enrollment contract for the remainder of the year the student attends the school. The terms of this contract may be amended by the school from time to time, so there's that flexibility. Will continue in effect as long as the student remains enrolled in the school. The school agrees to notify the parent in writing, so that's enforceability. And then comprehensiveness, any significant changes made to the contract prior to or concurrent with the registration of each academic year. The school, you know, later on in this clause, the school is, again, covering itself with, you're signing the contract, we are entering into this agreement, but we also retain the right to make changes, suspend, terminate, et cetera, as needed and where needed, as determined by the school. So I think I see a chat or a Q&A coming in, so I'll pause there for that. Oh, Debbie, you're muted.
Oh, sorry. How many students do you typically lose prior to continuous enrollment versus post-continuous enrollment? How many exit interviews do you conduct each year? Mm-hmm. That was one question.
Yep. So at Montgomery, we were pretty much right at the NAIS average in terms of percentage of attrition. I would say we were maybe a couple, I would say this year we gained about 2% on our attrition. So if we were at 10% before, we're at 8%. If we were at 11%, we're at 9%. So the continuous enrollment, I would say, correlation, not necessarily causation, but it is interesting that the year that we moved to continuous enrollment, we also saw a drop in our attrition rate. I would say that the reception amongst the community and the families has been overwhelmingly positive. They're appreciative. They're like, yes, you just made our lives easier. So I think almost more importantly than the impact it had on our actual attrition was the morale boost and appreciation we got from our families in engaging around that process. Yeah, and then in terms of exit,
right? Enhancing the family experience, right?
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you follow Ian Simmons, he will talk about the seven tenets of good strategic enrollment management. And, you know, one of those core tenets is retention, and the heart of retention is good family experience. We want to make sure we're meeting people where they are, right? And in today's world, you know, as a millennial parent myself, right, I'm like, make it easy for me. I mean, you go to a website, I don't want to make a new account. I want to just do single sign-on with Google. Like, let me just click Google. I don't want to make 1,800 different passwords, right? Don't make me sign a re-enrollment contract. I'm not going anywhere, So again, kind of meeting families where they are. But exit interviews, I will do an exit interview with every single family that leaves. And again, one of the nice things about the way that we did it in terms of requiring families to fill out a formal withdrawal form, they can't just email me and say, hey, we're leaving. They can email me and say that, and then I'll say, okay, well, you need to complete this withdrawal form, and then we're going to have a phone call. And then during that phone call, I can get an exit interview done. And so it has enhanced and increased the number of phone calls that I'm doing with families. I mean, we're a relatively small school, so I can handle that by myself. Bigger offices might want to structure things in a way that you'll be able to manage. But I'm exit interviewing every single family.
And most importantly, you're gathering that data. That data is critical. Another question, how does this work with financial aid applicants?
Yes, that's a great question. We're going to talk about that in an upcoming slide, but that's another big one that we get. And actually, our solution to that was pretty simple. And so I'll talk about that in the coming slides for sure.
All right. And then one more question, maybe this is coming up, but do you have a sample withdrawal form that you could share or a sample sort of overview of your withdrawal form that you might be willing to talk about?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. I don't think I put any language from the withdrawal form on the slide, but yeah, it's very, very, very simple. And I can provide a sample along with this slide deck too.
Great. All set with questions.
Awesome. So some of the key structural changes that I would recommend. So this is where we actually going to talk about financial aid a little bit, but in the enrollment agreement for continuous enrollment, you want to include language that stipulates tuition and fees are going to be communicated separately. So that's the key, right? You're signing a contract. You're not attaching the tuition and fees to the contract that the family is signing. This is one of the most fundamental structural changes for a perpetual enrollment versus re-enrollment contracts, right? So in a normal re-enrollment contract, we'll say, yes, you know, I'm enrolling in my school and this is going to be my tuition rate, you know, whether it's full pay or financial aid, that gives you the actual number. And then you're signing the contract that has the number on it. This would be different in that you sign one continuous agreement with the understanding that the school is going to notify you of what your bill is going to look like during the same time that you would normally notify parents about what next year's tuition is going to look like. And again, the same thing with financial aid in a separate letter. So for instance, what we did at Montgomery was we would always announce next year's tuition in our head of school letter at the beginning of February. And it would say, you know, this is what tuition is going to be next year. Here's why we're making this, you know, our tuition next year. And attached here is a schedule of all of our tuition and fees so that you can review. So that's essentially where we're like Netflix, right? Like, again, Netflix changes its prices off and on. They don't make you sign a whole new contract every time they change their prices. They just send you an email that says, hey, starting blah, blah, blah date, you're now going to be paying, you know, $15.89 a month for Netflix instead of $12.89, you know, and if you have a problem, then you can contact us. And so basically we do the same thing. We say, here's what your tuition is going to be at our school for the coming year. This is what it is. And you're going to be billed accordingly when we start our billing cycle. And if you have any questions, you can reach out to Drew. And so that's that. And it's here in the language. Parent understands that on or about February 1st of each academic year. And again, we put on or about, again, flexibility, comprehensiveness. Don't tie yourself to like a hard date. On or about could be anywhere, you know, plus or minus a week of February 1st. We give ourselves that flexibility. School will notify parent of the amount of tuition, registration, finance charges, and related fees for next academic year and the date by which fees must be paid to reserve a student for the next academic year. School will assume that parent intends to re-enroll on the same payment plan unless you've received a contrary notification. So again, simple, right? Families are going to choose their payment plan when they first sign their enrollment agreement. If they want to change that each year, all they have to do is just notify the business office. Again, no big deal there. And we're just asking that they notify the payment plan change prior to March 1st. School will bill parent for applicable registration fees. So that is something that we are continuing to do, right? With your re-enrollment, classic re-enrollment contract model, you're signing that re-enrollment contract and then you are giving a deposit. And so we're sort of stuck in this, well, this is great. But if they're not giving you a deposit, how do you know they're really coming back? Well, two things I would say to that. Number one is you've created a contract that is enforceable, right? Just by virtue of them having signed it. The second thing is we do actually want to have them put some kind of payment up front. And we just changed the language from deposit to registration fee. And so we just, and again, but instead of having parents write separate checks for deposits, we're just billing them for an extra registration fee the same time that we would have asked for a deposit for the next year. So really didn't change anything there. And so what happens is that if the parents are not paying the fee by the deadline, the contract says, then we're not going to continue enrollment for that student. And we may offer that student space to other students. So what that has allowed us to do at Montgomery is we've been able to identify attrition risks that otherwise would have been hidden from us a lot earlier in the process. So the conversation becomes, hey, I see that you haven't paid your registration fee on time. What's up? What's going on? Do you need some help? How can we help you with that? And then during that conversation, it might come out, well, you know, we're not sure what we're going to do. For us, we're asking for that registration fee on March 15th, but the drop dead deadline for no penalty withdrawals from the contract isn't until April 30th. So what we have there is essentially a 6-week window to work with families who have now presented as attrition risks because they haven't paid that registration fee. And zero in on those risks while everybody else who was always going to come back anyway is just back. And so again, that speaks to that solving for efficiency thing where we're really now able to identify and hone in on the families who are true risks versus just that sort of scatter approach where you're reaching out to everybody and spending a lot of time working with families who really don't necessarily need to be chased down. Or communicated with in that way. Creating that separate notification of here's what the tuition is going to be next year, and that would go to everybody. And then for your financial aid families, we always do our very best to ensure that the financial aid information was going out at the same time as the re-enrollment information. And so instead of sending a re-enrollment contract and an attached financial aid letter, we're simply sending out a financial aid letter or scholarship letter or remission letter to any families who are not paying the full tuition. And that, again, that letter is simply for their records, notifying them that they are continuing to receive financial aid or merit scholarship or remission, and this is the amount. So please retain this for your records because this is what your billing is going to look like for the coming year. So again, it becomes more of a billing notification than something that they have to do, you know, some kind of action on. And again, I'll stop there for any questions that might be coming up.
All right, no questions at the moment. People can just jump in as you go. And Drew, thanks. This is so clear, and I know people are appreciative of the manner in which you're presenting this. So thank you.
Sure, my pleasure. All right, so moving forward, some of the stipulations and procedures that we built in, discontinued enrollment procedure. So there you go, there's that, you have to give that written notice in the form of our formal withdrawal form. We put in the termination dates, right? So that's that drop dead deadline, as I mentioned, for us was April 30th. So if you want to withdraw from your contract without penalty, you have to do that before April 30th. So again, there was that March 15th to April 30th, we gave ourselves that 6-week period to work with families who hadn't paid their deposit or registration fee on time. And then again, termination of students' attendance, this was that flexibility that we gave ourselves to still be able to make those changes to, you know, take action on a student contract that in a normal previous, you know, sort of classic re-enrollment scenario, we would have maybe held that contract. School has the right to suspend, terminate attendance of a student for reasons set forth in this contract, reasons set forth in the student handbook, or other published document for reasons school administration considers detrimental to school community, student or other students of school, parents' failure to pay all or any part of financial obligations. So academic reason, behavioral reason, financial reason, we've got ourselves covered there. So again, if you decide to go in this way, that's why it's so critical for you to work with a law firm that has experience writing these agreements and is going to write it with you from the ground up so that it's going to appropriately cover your school and cover your parents in an agreement that's clear and is going to be lasting. Because theoretically, this is an agreement that could be for us up to 10 years, for other schools, maybe even up to 15 years if you're a pre-K through 12. One of the things that I will just quickly note, because we moved from a one-page to a 10-page contract, it kind of necessitated moving to an electronic contract because mailing out packets that are, you know, 15 to 20 pages thick to everybody was just going to be crazy. So we did move to an e-sign setup. We had just moved to school admin, so it was really easy to host our contract in the system. But before that, we had been using a company that was kind of like DocuSign to host our contracts and have families sign that way. But I made sure that for any sort of call out clauses, such as the ones that I've highlighted here, there were areas for families to initial next to those clauses. Because I think realistically, we know families aren't necessarily going to read all 10 pages of said contract, but we want to make sure that they're noting some of the really key structural pieces in here so that we can, if you ever did have to go back, you know, God forbid, in a kind of enforceability situation, you have that document they point to and they say, well, I didn't know the termination date was April 30th. It's, well, you signed your initials right next to it. So, you know, you want to make sure you're covering yourself in that way. And then again, also allowing families to select their payment option when they do that initial continuous enrollment contract. So for us, we do a 1, 2, and a 10. And you might have some similar options too. Again, pausing for any questions that might be coming in.
No, all good so far.
Okay, great. So what does the implementation process look like? And what are some of the lessons that we learned? I've definitely been talking a little bit about some of those lessons learned, but I'll give you a little calendar here in terms of what you might look at for an implementation process. So June through August in year one, so that's now, you're going to want to do your approval and start drafting your contract. So make sure your decision makers are on board. When we went to a continuous enrollment contract, I made a pitch to the board at the last finance committee meeting of the year, just saying, hey, we want to look at this. Obviously, the board isn't getting involved in operational decisions, but we do want to make sure that the finance committee, the governance committee was aware of such a big change we were making in terms of how families interacted with the school. So we were really upfront with the board about what we were doing. And they were all very, very supportive of this move. And they kind of, the reaction essentially was, well, that makes all sense in the world. Why would you not? And then we, with that blessing, the head of school, myself, our CFO, worked with legal counsel. Again, we got a firm that specialized, that had done school continuous enrollment contracts in the past. And we started the drafting process. We started with the contract we had, and then looked to that and made a list of things that we wanted to be present in a continuous enrollment situation. And then the lawyers used their expertise to draft up that 10-page contract, which we then went back and forth. Add this, why is this here? Very much, you know, in that drafting process, I don't know how many drafts we went through. It must've been at least half a dozen. And we started that process over that first summer. Recognizing that this new agreement is going to be much more complex than our previous one. Starting in September, when the families are back on campus, that was when I started the communication process. And just as flexibility, enforceability, and comprehensiveness are key to a successful continuous enrollment agreement, I would say on the community side, communication with your families was our best ally. So I would say I probably over-communicated this with our families, but it really paid off, because by the time we got around to offering the first continuous enrollment agreements, I didn't have any questions. Families were 100% on board. They were clear about what they were doing. They understood what they were signing. And that really smoothed out the whole process of switching from a re-enrollment to a continuous enrollment. And as we all know, switching such a major part of the process can sometimes feel daunting, because you're wondering how the parent community is going to deal with such a big structural change. So I started monthly communications. I was directly emailing families. I wasn't necessarily, putting that announcement in with like our annual or weekly newsletter. I was doing direct emails to the entire community. I would say consider maybe varying up the media for that messaging. Like I did some like funny, like friendly videos. I did different little infographs. And then there was like the classic sort of just paragraph text of here's what we're doing, here's why we're doing it. I would also recommend offering some meetings or Zooms, maybe try and catch parents, see if you can catch them for a coffee, or offer some Zoom webinars or anything for families who might be interested and might have questions about the logistics of what you're doing and why you're doing it and what it means for their daily lives.
Real quick question just related to mm-hmm. the families. Can parents later change their payment option? And if so, do they need to sign a whole new contract, or is that handled on the business office side, or how does that work?
Yeah. Yes. And the latter, they can just handle that in the business office side. They don't have to sign a whole new contract to change their billing cycle. And our business office has been great with that. And they're like, yeah, no problem. Just like when we were on the re-enrollment contract, I mean, you would certainly get people who would choose the 10 payment and then, you know, sometime weeks or months later, like, actually, no, we want to go to the 2 payment. We definitely never made them re-sign contracts, even when we were on the old traditional re-enrollment model. So that was no problem. That's just a note to the business office. That was super easy.
And then another thing you referenced was just law firms that have experience with this. Were those local law firms for you, or are those firms that you could recommend for folks to give a call to?
Yeah, ours was local, I think. I don't know 100% if they were only local or if they were part of a larger network. I would certainly be happy to share the name of the firm that we used. And then, you know, kind of go from there. But I think we got connected with the firm that we used just with our retained counsel, just because of the connections he had. So, I mean, it would be just as easy to talk to your school lawyer and say, hey, do you know of any firms or people that do this? Or do you?
I was going to suggest that. And I was also going to say, you know, this is the time and very commonplace to be examining enrollment contracts. Obviously, with the pandemic, there are all sorts of new clauses and language that have been inserted into enrollment contracts that folks may or may not have had beforehand. So I imagine there are law firms out there that are dealing with a lot of this type of contract language for schools in general. So,
yeah. Absolutely. So then the implementation phase, I would say, would be sort of the December to April. So that would be, you know, this December through next April. And I went from monthly communications to biweekly communication, again, reminding parents what was coming. Again, I would say consider moving to an electronic contract if you're not already on electronic contract, because once you get this kind of agreement drafted, it's most likely going to be multiple pages and, you know, hard to print, expensive to mail, just messy opportunities for things to go wrong. So I would say electronic contracts with DocuSign, or if your EMS system allows you to have electronic contracts, that's great. And the other thing too is the electronic contracts ensure that families have easy access. When you're signing an online document, you always get that copy in your email. You always have access to that copy somewhere. And we directed parents, like, make sure that you're downloading a PDF of this for your own records when you sign it. It's a lot easier than all those contracts getting lost on the countertops of America. And then what happens then in the coming years, then they will sign the contract the same way they always have, right? So late January, early February, the continuous enrollment contract comes out, and effectively that's the last enrollment contract that your families would have to sign in terms of returning families. So that first year, it doesn't actually change the mechanics of what they're doing at all. It's just the document that they're signing has different stipulations. So again, it's an easy kind of like glide into a new procedure. Then I kind of left the families alone over the following summer. So this would be now September to November of 2023 is our next calendar point here. And I went back to monthly reminders. So for me, this was this last September through November. So September, November of 2021, I went back to monthly reminders, reminding families, hey, we've moved to this new contract system. You are not going to get an enrollment contract this spring. So when you don't see something in your email box or on your EMS or in your physical mailbox, don't freak out because you already signed it. Instead, now it's parent education around timing on if they choose to leave and reminding them to get started on their financial aid and reminding them how they're going to know what they're going to need to pay the following year. So did that monthly September through November and then finished up with December through April. That was the first continuous season. So winter of 2021 through spring of 2022 was our first sort of seeing the benefits and the fallout of switching to this system. I went to biweekly reminders in December. Again, different media, you know, make a little video, make a little infographic if you can, whatever. Just keep it fresh, offer some meetings, but remind parents that at the end of January, you're not actually going to get a contract. You don't have to sign anything. You're here unless you want to tell us that you're not. And by the way, here's the withdrawal process and here are the deadlines. Just reminding people about that process. And then I worked really closely with the business office. So once the registration fee deadline had approached and then passed, the business office would share with me weekly updates on, you know, who had taken care of those fees and who had not. And I was able to look at that list and say, okay, well, these are families who are late because, you know, one reason or another, these are families who are late. Now I'm worried about they might be attrition risk. So I'm going to go in, zero in on those families and start some conversations. And then over that period of 6 weeks between March 30th and or March 15th and April 30th, was able to work with those families to get some clarity around what their plans were and what was going on and how we could help them. And that I think was where some of that attrition savings, if you will, started to surface and started to pay off a little bit. Yeah, pausing there for any questions on the calendar, implementation calendar.
Yeah, no questions, we're good.
Okay, great. So a couple tips, make sure you get your board and of course your head of school and your CFO on board. Items to address were some of the questions that folks have already asked. How would tuition increases work, right? We are same way as before. We're notifying families that this is gonna be our new tuition for the following year and your billing is gonna reflect that. How does financial aid work? Kind of the same thing, right? But you're sending those tuition increase letters, you're sending those financial aid letters separately from the contract and telling people, just retain these for your records. They're confirming for you what your billing is gonna look like. And again, the appeals process for financial aid doesn't change. If a family has a question about their award, about their grant, they wanna appeal for whatever reason, same exact process. The financial aid season did not feel any different to me this year than it had in the past. What happens if we need to dismiss a student? Again, same thing. You want to cover yourself with that flexibility clause or clauses in the contract that the lawyer is going to draft up for you that allows the school to make changes, terminations, dismissals as it sees fit according to the school rules, the handbook, billing, what have you. And that kind of bleeds into this next question about what if you have to put an academic or financial aid hold on. Is the contract enforceable? Well, again, I certainly hope so. If you're getting a good reputable law firm to draw that up for you, it should be enforceable. That law firm needs to know what the rules and restrictions in your particular state are around such agreements. There are some states that are really particular about multi-year contracts, and there are some states that are not as particular around those. And the only way to navigate those waters is to ensure that you have a good in-state law firm that's going to be able to navigate them and draft up an agreement that's going to be enforceable for you in your state. How do you really know families are returning in the fall? Again, well, they've signed an agreement just like they have before, and they've paid a registration fee or deposit. And you're having conversations, right? Just like any other enrollment year. The core of our work is built on relationships. The difference here is that we are changing the nature of that relationship so that families will need to do the paperwork in order to leave the school instead of forcing families to do paperwork to stay in the school. But substantively, in terms of the relationships that you want to have with your families, that doesn't change. Annual tuition insurance would be another thing if you use DUER or whatever for that tuition refund premium. Our way of solving that was to simply build it into our tuition increase, and we're covering that for all of our families. So they don't have to pay an extra fee. They don't opt in or opt out. We just have everyone covered. And what that actually did was lower our premium a little bit because we had everybody in there. And we felt it was worth it to sort of subsidize that with a little bit of the tuition increase. And I think it was like a couple $100 per family at the end of the day. So it was easy to bake that into the tuition increase and have all the families covered. So that if a family does withdraw, if they do breach contract and it falls underneath the protection of the tuition refund plan, you know you have that protection. Pausing for any questions that come up on this one.
Yeah, there was a question. How do you estimate the number of new students you enroll? How do you estimate the number of new students you need to enroll if families do not pay the registration fees until March 15th?
Right. I mean, well, that's exactly the same problem that you have with the re-enrollment contracts. What was nice was a heck of a lot more families for us paid their registration fees on time because, again, we were just automatically billing them versus families who were not returning their re-enrollment contracts and deposits. So we had a lot more clarity on what our enrollment looked like way earlier, which allowed us to know exactly how many new students we had space for much, much earlier in the year than we had when we were on the previous traditional system of getting re-enrollment contracts. So I think we knew what our enrollment was going to look like, you know, by the time April 30th rolled around. We were really confident about our numbers versus, you know, in previous years where, you know, it's June 9th and we might still have, you know, a dozen or more question marks. So that was this was a huge help in solving precisely that problem.
Sorry, there is another question.
Yeah.
We got that. Sorry about that. All set.
Okay, great. A couple of lessons learned. I know some of the stuff, again, I've already covered, but it bears repeating. Definitely engage legal counsel. You do not try to just crib another school's contract. Be sure that this is going to be custom built for your school from the ground up. You got to make sure you've got all your bases covered. As the NAIS report very eloquently summarizes, you know, there are risks to moving to this kind of system. And those risks are kind of centered around things like how you're communicating this to families, how clear your contract is, how enforceable it is in, you know, in the legal system in your state. Because again, this is a multiple year contract that implies many, many thousands of dollars attached to it. So you want to make sure that it's as tight as possible. Again, electronic contracts are key. You're going to have a really complex agreement, probably more complex than what you currently have. And so having that electronically just makes the whole document handling part of this a lot easier. You have to definitely do separate tuition schedule and financial aid letters, because with a continuous process, you can't tie the tuition to the contract because then you're updating your tuition every year And so then you're back to signing a new contract every year. So that kind of is self-defeating. The other thing you wouldn't obviously want to do is bring them in at a certain level when they first come in, and then have the continuous enrollment, hold them at flat with their tuition for the entire time they're enrolled at your school. You'd be leaving thousands of dollars on the table. So separating out your tuition schedule and financial aid letters, again, thinking of them as basically we're just functioning the same way Netflix is functioning or any other service is functioning, saying, here's your new rate. Any questions, contact us. Make sure that you have a formal withdrawal process where families have to reach out to you to get the form. You're going to have a conversation. It gives you an opportunity for an exit interview. It gives you an opportunity to directly speak with the family and see if there's a way to salvage the enrollment, you know, if you haven't already been actively working with the family around retention. I would say just we changed our nomenclature from deposit to registration fee because that just seemed to make sense. And that's, you know, that's more kind of university language too. I mean, if you think about it, colleges have been doing essentially continuous enrollment for a very long time. You know, I don't think when I was in college, which is starting to be a while ago, my parents weren't signing a new contract for me to be in college every year. We signed up the one time and then that was it. So, but we had those registration fees every year. So it's the same kind of idea that, you know, universities have been doing for a long time. Budgeting was way easier. We were able to predict our sections and our class sizes much sooner, which meant that we knew how much room we had for new students. We were able to zero in and start our wait lists with a lot more confidence earlier. We were able to have more clarity around what our net tuition revenue was going to look like, which allowed us to budget around faculty and staff raises and what compensation was going to look like. I would say one of the surprises was more attrition surfaced earlier. And maybe it wasn't a surprise because I think that was kind of part of the point, but it was a little bit scary when we reached our annual average attrition in terms of like raw numbers of students that we thought might be leaving, you know, a solid like 2 or 3 months earlier than we normally would reach that number. So that looked a little scary because, you know, it's March and all of a sudden we've got, you know, all of these students who are on our high risk attrition list. What it allowed us to do was, again, we had more clarity around who was coming back and who wasn't coming back and how many seats we had available, and also gave us the opportunity to work with those families, and we were able to salvage some of those enrollments. I might say we didn't do this, but I might suggest maybe consider adding a signature to the financial aid letter, just so you have kind of literally all your T's crossed and I's dotted. So the financial aid letter itself is not so much a contract, but it's a just sort of a recognition from the family that, yes, I saw this. Yes, I'm agreeing to it. I haven't done that. But it's something you might want to think about is, do we want to have financial aid families sign their FA letters? And that's totally up to you. Might be a good thing to do. It was a huge shift in the amount of time that I was able to spend with my new families. And we were, you know, well ahead of our previous year benchmarks in the number of new families that we brought into the school. And I would say a big result of that, or a big reason for that result, was the fact that we moved to a continuous enrollment. So I was spending far less time with current families trying to chase them down for contracts and far more time with my admissions pipeline, nurturing families through the process and getting from inquiry to enrollment much more efficiently. And then the whole school, students don't know about it, but parents, teachers, you know, administration, everybody thought, you know, this has been a really, really helpful thing. I didn't get any negative feedback about it. I didn't get a lot of feedback about it at all, really, in terms of written feedback via email. And the little bit of feedback I did get was, hey, this was great. So much easier. Thanks for, you know, taking that off my plate. So it was a really positive reception. And then, you know, we'll share some supplementary materials and samples automatically. And then anything deeper than that, I'm happy to share in a one-on-one request situation. I have to give a huge, huge shout out again to Sam Geisler and Orna Siegel as well, As Orna would tell you if you were to talk to her, I was on the phone with her, I don't know, probably two or three times a week when we were considering this, and she was sharing her insights into how she moved her school to continuous enrollment. So she was just a really good friend and a really good resource as we looked at doing this at our school. And then if you do want to get in touch, my Montgomery email is going to be defunct pretty soon. So do email me at my new Clarity Tuition email, which is drew@claritytuition.com.
Drew, thank you. This is awesome. I so appreciate your going back to 2019 and Larry Jensen and Sam Geisler, because I think was sitting in that session, and Larry had done a couple of those sessions over the years. And this is really one of those, helping your colleagues in other schools to jump, take the leap of faith, because there is that piece where it's like, oh, this sounds good, but where do I start and how do I get this done? So awesome presentation, very clear, really helpful in terms of resources. Would love to just allow anybody to ask any final questions in the chat box or the Q&A box. Happy to cover those for the group. And otherwise, we'll allow folks to reach out to Drew personally. All right, one question. Yes, are we able to get the recording of this presentation to share with our business office? Yes. So as with all of our webinars, you will receive notice that within 24 hours that the recording is posted, that the resources are posted, Drew's slides will be posted. Your business office may need to watch it from your computer, but we can get into that later. If someone in your business office is registered on your ASAP account, they can also essentially register for this event and watch it through their own computer. So happy to talk more about that if there are more questions about that. But otherwise, yes, by all means, that's the point of this and why we so appreciated the timing of this, is that it allows you really, as Drew said, to work with your board, your head, your business office in the month of June, June and July, and then get some of these other pieces going. So thanks again, Drew. I know you have another meeting at 2:00, and thank you, everybody. We hope to see many of you at our annual Institute in Chicago. Drew will be presenting again there on his favorite topic, net tuition revenue. And we'll be there, obviously, with Clarity Tuition. So thanks again, and hope to see all of you soon. Take care.
Thanks so much, Debbie. Thanks, everyone.